Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Do you know your net worth? Or can you even list all your financial accounts? Believe it or not, most people can't. The problem is simple. When you don't track your finances, you leave hard-earned money on the table by overspending and undersaving. Monarch is the solution. An all-in-one personal finance tool that brings your entire financial life together in one clean interface on your laptop or phone. In just minutes, you can link all your accounts to see a clear, complete picture of your financial health. With data visualizations and AI-driven insights, Monarch helps you spot patterns, cut wasteful spending, and make better financial decisions without ever touching a spreadsheet. Monarch more than pays for itself. In fact, users save over $200 a month on average. That's why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch the best budgeting app of 2025. Get 50% off your first year. That's just $50 total when you use code BALANCE at monarch.com. That's monarch.com, promo code BALANCE. Monarch, the modern way to manage money.
Because when you lift up segments of our community, everybody comes up. It's not like you just pull up one one group, but this administration wants to do that. If you are aligned politically, if you look like them, then, you know, we have a shot. And everyone else is collateral damage.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, I'm delighted to be on the Lincoln Project podcast today, joined by a person whose name I think you're going to get to know a lot better in the coming weeks, months, and years. It's Adelita Grijalva. She is the newly elected member of Congress that Mike Johnson is refusing to swear in for Mike Johnson's various nefarious purposes. So I want to welcome you to the show today. Thank you so much for coming on. I know you have been deluged with folks who are asking you that one question over and over again. When is Mike Johnson going to do the right thing and swear you in?
I wish I had an answer that was different and updated, but unfortunately, I don't. We still have had no direct communication with the Speaker's office. Everything that I have heard has been through media, or, you know, a reporter has asked a question. But ultimately, what I'm hearing very clearly is until Congress is back in session, I will not be getting sworn in.
Even though Jimmy Patronis and Randy Fine, two people who are the most, who I know from Florida politics, are generally, like, not great guys. They were sworn in a special, like, back of the room session without any fanfare. You're not asking for any fanfare. You just want to get to work for the people of Arizona, right?
That is exactly right. And so Patronis and Fine were elected on April 1st, April Fool's Day. I don't know. I might have changed the date if I were part of that. I just thought it and I, oh no, I wouldn't do that. But, you know, and less than 24 hours later, on a pro forma session, they were sworn in. And Speaker Johnson had said, well, it's because their family was there. And I'll push back and say, I'll bring my family. Can I just sit on the office? And my three kids and my husband were ready to go. Yeah.
So I want to ask you, look, the linchpin of this story is that you've said you'd be one of the 218th vote to sign the discharge petition on Epstein. That's not why you ran for Congress. That's not why you sought this work. That's not why you're trying to get sworn in. Tell us a little bit about I want to come back to that in a minute, but tell us about, you know, why you decided to run and talk about your family's tradition of service in Arizona. And because I do want people to get to know you a little better, because I think you've got a really good approach to things. And I'm hoping we can get, you know, get it so that you don't appear to be somebody who's just caught in the jaws of this stupid controversy and somebody who's going to be a real leader in Congress.
Well, I appreciate that. So my dad, Congressman Raul Grijalva, ran for office and held this position for 22 years. Before that, he gave about 30 years of his life to, you know, being on the school board or the Pima County Board of Supervisors. And so literally 50 years of his life in public service. So growing up as the daughter of, that's always sort of been, I mean, he set the bar very high. And
yep.
So I'm one of, you know, me and my two sisters. So there's three of us. My dad mm-hmm. was very lucky and had three girls. Good for him. And he really...
opinions vary whether that's lucky or not.
It's very lucky. I think it's very lucky for him. He might have argued different, but yes. So I really have followed in his footsteps. You know, I served, he was on the TUSD board. I was on the TUSD board. I served longer. I'm tied as the longest serving, 20 years. It's a volunteer, elected but volunteer position. And then during that time, I ran a juvenile diversion program called Teen Court. And so almost 26 years on a program that is designed to break the school to prison pipeline. And really figure out alternatives and help young people understand, why did I commit this crime, shoplifting, fighting, possession of drugs, any of those things, also at school, in the community, and how do I learn from it? And so as a result, over 90% of the thousands of young people that came through that program have never been rearrested again. So it's pretty cool to go through the community and say, hey, there was this program I did. It looked like a courtroom. I'm like, yes, that's great. So I was there for almost 26 years. And left that position when I was elected to the Pima County Board of Supervisors. And so in that work, my dad, if you come to Arizona at all and you go to Phoenix and you come to Tucson, you can see the difference. It's like, wow, why is it so much greener? And there, you know, plants, life, and riparian habitat. And that is the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan. And my dad worked very hard on that. And a majority of the board on a 3-2 protected all of this area. And so part of why I wanted to run is just to do the same and increase the protections, our environmental protections, because once it's gone, it's gone. And so, worked on affordable housing, preschool. I mean, my connection with the school board, I mean, all of those things have been really instrumental in why I decided to run for reelection on the TUSD board. And I was reelected by over 70% of the vote in January and resigned in April after my dad passed away in order to run for office. Right. And so
And you ran a great campaign and won a sweeping victory.
Yep. We did in the primary and the general.
Was it 67% of the vote? Something like
that? I think we're at 68. I mean, we have trickles in, but yes, we were on election night. We were 71 and I was
underachiever.
We're just going to stick with that number. 2-1. We'll go with that one. That's an accurate.
There you go. Well, I just a quick side story. I only met your dad one time. I was out at the Tucson Book Festival one year and we were on a plane back to DC together and sat chit-chatting for a little while about Tucson and about the work he was doing. So, so I want to ask you this question and get back into a little bit of the things that are affecting people across this country right now. We've got this government shutdown that Donald Trump has chosen and Mike Johnson has chosen. They're holding not only your district in your state has a lot of rural hospitals. It has a lot of defense, employees. It has a lot of government employees. It has a lot of government retirees, both your district and the whole state. Do you think that your Republican future colleagues, however you want to phrase it, do they have an understanding yet of how badly this is hurting them? Because it is really, I mean, all the polling everywhere, and I think the impact of things like rural hospitals in your state, it's going to be enormous. Do they understand yet how bad this is blowing up on the, in their faces?
No, I don't. I think that they continue to spin it as, you know, we're winning this, that, you know, this game in the public's eye,
right.
But really it's real life people. And so just in Arizona, we have 58,000 federal employees, you know, 10,700 civilian federal employees. And just in CD7, there are two rural hospitals and two that are that serve CD7 residents. So a total of four rural hospitals that are in danger of closing.
While the blame game continues in Washington, small towns and rural areas have already been dealing with decreases in service and care.
Across the country, hospitals are vanishing, and a new wave of Medicaid cuts could accelerate the collapse. President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill slashes nearly $1 trillion in Medicaid funding over the next 10 years. The administration says this cuts wasteful spending and will create a $50 billion fund for rural hospitals. But many health experts say that's not nearly enough. And already, nearly 100 rural hospitals have closed or eliminated inpatient services in the last decade, threatening healthcare access to some of the more than 16 million people living in rural communities who rely on Medicaid. While the full impact of Medicaid cuts can take years to unfold, doctors tell us the system is already buckling.
The closure of the hospitals here, it's not just a loss of care, it's actually a loss of life.
It is really loss of time, which in a critical disease state is super important, and it can be loss of life.
The closures that are occurring across the country should be a wake-up call about the crisis rural healthcare providers are facing.
And so what that means is you have people that are in active chemo treatment that are going to have to travel 3.5 hours to get that treatment as opposed to having that done right around the corner from their home. You have not just hospitals, you have clinics, you have rural programs. The first thing that is going to be done once these cuts are implemented is that those satellite programs are going to shut down and people are going to have to come closer to Tucson or Phoenix, which is really, this district is really diverse. It takes me 4.5 hours to get to a corner. And so it's, I think, asking people to sacrifice that way. Logistically, some can't. And it will be, when we say that this is life-saving healthcare, it is. I mean, it's going to change lives of so many people. 1 in 5 children, these are babies, 1 in 5 are going to lose their healthcare.
Right.
I just don't get it.
It is really, again, I honestly think they're so swept up in obeying Trump on pass my bill. And, you know, a district like yours, which has very affluent people and very poor people spread out, as you pointed out correctly, over an area bigger than Rhode Island, bigger than a lot of states, it really strikes me that they have not weighed the human toll of not only the big bad bill, but of the shutdown itself.
Yep. And I think that, you know, so many people, I don't know one person that can go without a check. I mean, I haven't been working since April. So I don't know the last time some of these people have gone to the grocery store and tried to buy groceries for a week. I have 3 kids, as I mentioned. You know, I can go in and spend $100 and that basically walk out with 2 little bags of stuff. And so that's reality for so many people. Like, we cannot go without. And that's what's going to be happening. Our food banks are already stretched so thin because you have so many working families that never needed that kind of assistance before are knocking on the door of all of these programs that are around us here for families in need. And I know I've talked to people who are like, I never thought that would be me. Like, I never thought that I would be in this position. But, you know, my wife lost her job in the first round of federal cuts, and now I'm on furlough. And when Trump threatens, not only are we not going to pay you, but we might not back pay you, and you might lose your job. I mean, the amount of stress that is putting families in is just, I can't even imagine it. And then you couple that with this just hateful immigration policy that is dividing families. I mean, I am the three ports of entry with Mexico are in CD7. Mm-hmm. We have a very vibrant Latino community. And when I go to restaurants, they're empty. I mean, I've talked to so many people who said, I think we're going to have to close our restaurant or we're going to have to close this service. Anyone in the service industry, they're not seeing people coming in because people are afraid.
Sure. I mean, in agriculture, in construction, in service industries, in home health care, all these things. And you know, I have some news for the MAGA listeners out there. These people are not MS-13 or Trindade-Agua terrorists or criminals. They're here to work. And they're being treated like they are horrifying criminals, and they're just not. And I think, you know, I'm from Florida. We see it here. We have a very diverse population in Florida, and folks are terrified. And the food services industry, the construction trades, agriculture, they're all taking an enormous hit. I think, and our, you know, both of our states are going to be very deeply impacted by this, not only the human toll of it, but the economic cost when we're already teetering on a recession. I mean, I think the combination of the immigration and the tariff stuff has really is a poison pill for this economy.
And when you see that our closest allies are now going to just avoid working with the U.S. altogether, I'm like, okay, Canada and Mexico, they're going to get their own system going and exclude us because, you know, Trump keeps playing games as if everyone desperately needs the U.S. without acknowledging the fact that we need them. I mean, this is a symbiotic relationship that now they're deciding that they're going to just avoid working with us altogether. And I can't blame them. And when you see that Canada and Mexico's economies are improving and ours is going down, does that scare anybody? Because it scares me.
Right. Job growth in Mexico is up. Inflation in Mexico is down. Oh. Prices in Mexico are down. Same thing in Canada. Canada's job growth is a little less whatever. But there, I mean, it's so strange that that Trump has taken something that American presidents of both parties for our entire lifetime understood Canada and Mexico were our neighbors and our friends and our allies and our partners. And now to make a very small fraction of Americans happy, you've got the Stephen Miller fantasy where, you know, we're going to go to war with Mexico. We're going to go to war with Canada. We're going to go to war with Greenland. We're going to go to war with Venezuela. And it's so, I think the thing that just keeps blowing my mind is, you know, I can remember, you know, and you and I may have disagreed on George W. Bush, but George W. Bush understood that our neighbor, Mexico, was not a hostile power.
Right.
And Ronald Reagan, you know, understood our neighbor was not a hostile power. And it just, to my mind, the short-sightedness of it is something we're going to pay a price for a very long time.
You know, he has to scapegoat somebody. You know, he has to point to somebody. Yeah. It can't be the policies that he implemented that we had to dig out of, right? That we had to dig out of all of this. And he was handed a really great economy by two different Democratic presidents and saw them both go down the toilet. And so here we are, and part of the problem is you have people that are struggling. They're struggling. Every race, creed, and color, we're struggling. But unfortunately, so many people want to have someone to blame. They want to blame somebody. It's like you chose not to go for higher education. You chose not to do different things. You didn't have opportunities. I understand all of that. But attacking programs that are trying to open doors of opportunity for people is not a solution either. Because when you lift up segments of our community, everybody comes up. It's not like you just pull up one group. But this administration wants to do that. If you are aligned politically, if you look like them, then, you know, we have a shot. And everyone else is collateral damage. And we have to fight against,
you know, it's just such a zero-sum game, and that's not how America should work. So I want to go back for a moment. You've got Mike Johnson holding up your swearing in for the worst and stupidest reasons.
When are you going to swear in Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva?
As soon as we get back to legislative session, when Chuck Schumer allows us to turn the lights back on.
Why haven't you done it already?
Because this is the way the institution works. I'm following the Pelosi precedent, by the way, when my dear friend from Louisiana, Julia Letlow, was elected to fill the seat of her deceased husband because of COVID. Nancy Pelosi took 25 days to swear her in.
Are you saying that Nancy Pelosi refused to swear her in earlier?
No, I'm saying that's my very point is this is the normal process.
My understanding is that was the date that actually the representative-elect Letlow at the time requested. She had obviously her.
Okay, here's some more examples, okay?
But wait a minute. You mentioned the Pelosi precedent, but Pelosi didn't delay that.
Let me give you more of the Pelosi precedent, okay?
And what about the Johnson precedent? You swore in two Republicans the day after their election.
Sure
you could swear her in tomorrow, right?
I mean, no, not tomorrow. No, we couldn't. We wouldn't. There was an exception for two Floridians earlier in this Congress, but the reason was they were duly elected, they had a date set, they flew in all their friends and family, and the House went out of session.
So if she flies in friends and family, then
we don't have a date set.
Number one, he is desperate not to have that discharge petition have to take another step toward the Senate. He's desperately trying to keep that off the books.
Really, truly. I am not a conspiracy theorist person by nature. So I thought when people started saying he's not going to swear you in because of the Epstein files, I thought, stop, that's not going to happen. And then that's not it, right? Because I was there. There was a really beautiful ceremony for members of Congress that passed away that year. And so my mom and I were there and I was on in the cloakroom on the side when Representative Waukesha was sworn in. And it was so fast. And a couple members are like, oh, you're getting sworn in too, right? I said, no, my election is still, 2 weeks away. But I'm hoping to be here. And so this speaker has set up the precedent of under 24 hours, whether Congress is in session or not. And so perhaps we made some assumptions that were incorrect, but we weren't in a shutdown before. There was a pro forma session and I was literally on the floor. So we could have taken care of this very quickly. And I don't need a lot of pomp and circumstance. Our community doesn't either. I can have a celebration here. All I want to
be bada bip, bada boom, hand on the Bible, boom, you're done.
I don't even need a speech. We don't want to do that. Totally okay with that. But this community, especially in a shutdown, historically needs a lot of they need a lot of support, and constituent services are really critically important. CD7 has, my dad did an amazing job. That staff did an amazing job with constituent services. Mm-hmm. And so people expect that. So people are showing up at my dad's old office, which is all locked up, completely empty. It's really frustrating.
And that's literally your job as a member of Congress, I think that's the big differentiation right now is Republicans believe that their job is to carry out Donald Trump's agenda. And Democrats believe their job is to serve their constituents. And that's one of the real shames of this thing. But I don't think Mike Johnson is really equipped with that gene for shame. He is a guy now who will put this whole thing together. In his head, am I making Trump happy? If that's happening, I'm good. Even though it's bad for the country, bad for everyone's constituents, bad for your constituents.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
So let me ask you this. He's eventually going to break. They're eventually going back into regular session. The polling for the Republicans on this shutdown has been ghastly. It has been terrible. There's a lot of whispering going on. Are you ready to be in D.C. the minute this thing pops?
Oh, first, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yep, I got it.
Good, because this thing could fall apart. I think it's going to fall apart in days, not weeks. They don't have the political courage right now. They are slipping. They know it. I know the pollster for the Senate is telling the Republicans in the Senate, like, this is bad. You have to stop this. You're getting the blame. So you know, you represent one more seat as the majority gets smaller and smaller for the Republicans. And you've got 2026 coming up where there are a lot of Democratic seats that are looking very promising. What are you looking forward to working on if you guys are in the majority next time? What are your main focuses going to be in Congress when Knockwood, the Democrats are in the majority?
Definitely the Environmental Justice for All. That's a bill that my dad worked on very hard and in trying to make sure that communities have a voice and have consultation, especially tribal consultation, when environmental impacts are hitting them. I think that that's going to be really important. I really want to see Medicare for all. I really want to see us move forward policies that are good for working families. And that's where I think the Democrats, we lost a little bit of our focus. We need to focus on working families and how our policies are going to help people and acknowledge the fact that I have a daughter who's 18. For her entire lifetime, her memories from 18 to 25, they have not had a government that works for them at all. So when we talk about why we're losing young people, it's because we're not putting ourselves in their positions. We're not giving them an opportunity to have voice in our system, and we're not encouraging young leadership. And I think that that's going to be really important, especially in this election. You know, when we're looking at student loan forgiveness and nearly as free as possible higher education, trade programs. I mean, those are the things that make a difference for people. Affordable housing is critical. Covering our preschool programs and protecting our environment and more green jobs, those are all going to be things that we have to work on. And rebuilding this Department of Education, literally every department that Trump has just decimated from the inside, cut people without any real thought to it. I really feel like everyone in DOGE was looking at a spreadsheet and looking at the totals at the end going, well, that's a good amount. Let's circle that. We have to protect our veterans. Veterans Administration has been decimated with cuts. And these are people who put their lives on the line for
and
this
you guys
country.
Have a very high percentage of
yes,
veterans
we
in
do.
The state.
Yes, we do. And it's very scary to me how often veterans are not included in conversations in Republican circles. Like, to me, that's where
right.
it's so important. And the tariffs and our economy, I mean, when we have our farmers not able to provide fruits and vegetables throughout our nation and be able to trade them, we're going to have a lot mm-hmm. of work to do when Trump is done, because really Trump is enriching himself. That's what he's doing.
I mean, look, the corruption in the Trump orbit is so staggering. I don't even know. I mean, a lot of Democrats are like, I can't wait to impeach him again. I'm like, guys, you got a lot more to fix
exactly
than just
right.
another impeachment. You got a lot more to do than just another impeachment. The best way to break the legacy of Trump is to rebuild the legacy of American goodness, in my mind. You know, you mentioned the young voters and young people, and I think you made a really good point, is I think Democrats have to come at them less with PowerPoint presentations and big, thick books of policy, and more like, we get what's wrong right now for you. We get you can't pay student loans. We get you can't find a job. We get that you can't buy a house. We're going to do these simple things, not the complicated 400-page document, but the like, it starts with recognizing how bad the situation has been for young people in this country.
Well, and also I think the generation coming up, they're much more accepting in general of differences and like embracing them. And so what I have found very fascinating is this sort of divide where you have younger males that are just really frustrated and sort of leaning a little more to conservative ideology. And I think that it is so much of this creation of division, of making people that are different seem like they're against you. And this, in Trump specifically, I thought it was so telling when a reporter asked, you know, our nation is so divided. How are you going to bring them together? And he said, that's not my job. That to me is, you know, we have a society of have and have nots. And those of us that are in the have not category really need to unite together and look at who is really culpable for the situation in our nation.
Right.
It is not the working class.
Yep. Yeah, I think that there's a path back to relevance for the Democratic Party, and it runs through talking to working people in their language about things they really care about. Not the boutique issues, but the real things. Because yeah, you know, I had a Democrat in Florida say to me the other day, he goes, you know what, when I'm campaigning, nobody asks me about a lot of stuff that we think are our core issues. They asked me about property insurance.
Yep.
They asked me about transportation. They asked me about, you know, putting a roof on a local school. It's the small stuff.
Yep.
That if we listen better, I think we get a chance to make that pitch again.
And we have to get big money out of our politics and our campaigns. There's just, I mean, that to me was one of the most striking differences in the mm-hmm. other race. I mean, I ran for the school board 20 years, sure. right? I did two elections locally for county. Coming into this mm-hmm. environment, you know, I don't right. check a box.
There's a lot more zeros in the campaign budget.
That was scary. But it also, I don't check a box for the D trip.
No.
Veteran. I am not a Caucasian. I am not a male or female, depending on where you are. I don't have a big trust fund or a huge donor list that I can tap into. That none of that occurred. But in this community, 70% of people said, yeah, I want to go ahead and back her. And I just think that it's so important for us to have people that are invested in their communities and support them in this process. Because had it not been for unions, the Working Families Party, Progressive Democrats of America, I would not be here. And if I didn't have the support of our two senators and a lot of local leaders, I wouldn't be here. And I think that it's because we have this threat of tons of money coming in against you, because if you're not aligned with that one issue, then you know they're going to come after you.
It is.
It's very scary.
It is the trap. Yeah. It is the trap that everybody in politics is in this country, and unwinding citizens is really, really hard to do. I mean, I have to be like, I'm a realist about it. I think it's done more damage than, I mean, McCain-Feingold led his citizens, and citizens has put us all in this constant chase, and it's empowered Elon Musk to have a bigger impact in politics yep. than a guy in a local election. And that is not how the world should work, but it is. It's a tough assignment. I also wanted to say, I was very heartened to see your two senators, who I like both of them very much, go out there and really go at Mike Johnson.
Hey, it's been 3 weeks since Adelita Grijalva won the election to the United States Congress. She should be representing over 700,000 people in Congress. Problem is, Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, refuses to swear her in because he knows she is the last vote before they can pass a bill that leads to the release of the Epstein files. Mike Johnson is protecting the people who are in the Epstein files. That's what this is about. So if you can, call Mike Johnson's office.
Speaker Johnson is protecting pedophiles. That's what this is all about. The only reason Adelita Grijalva is not being sworn in right now is because he wants to protect whatever is in those files, all the pedophiles that would be revealed. And he wants to make sure every day that doesn't happen. He has one more day to protect all those pedophiles, whether it's involving Donald Trump or any of his rich elite friends. Every reason that he has ever come up with has changed from day one, day two, day three. The only thing that's been consistent the whole time that Speaker Johnson is trying to cover up the pedophiles. Is that clear enough? Speaker Johnson is covering up pedophiles, and in the process, Arizona does not have a congresswoman.
That was something that I was very pleased to see, because you know, they didn't have to do that, but they did it. I thought it was really good and an honorable thing for them to do.
And I don't know how far ahead that was planned. Nobody told me about it. I thought happened in real time, like everybody else did. But, you know, really, I am Senator Kelly lives in CD7. I am his congressional representative. And, you know, I do think that he takes that a little personally. And then his amazing wife, former Representative Gabby Giffords, we've known each other forever. He and she and my dad were really close. And so when I called and said, I'm going to run, they both were like, how do we help? Like instantly. So I really, that was really great because he didn't have to do that. There are a lot of people that said, let me just stay out of this one. I don't think I'm going to get involved in this one until after the primary. Then all of a sudden, I was.
Everybody's got friends when you win the primary.
But I think healthy primaries are good. I really do.
I do too. I'm a big fan.
It makes you gear up. Like, do I want this? I'm like, know, when I first entered this, my dad passed away March 13th. We announced on March 31st. There was not a lot of breathing room there. And I look back on some of those earlier videos and I see the tears. I still get them all the time, but it was like a constant presence. And so I thought, I don't know if I want to do this. And then when the race got really competitive and I saw who was going to be there, I'm like, okay, well, let's go. Ready to go. You have to do it.
Well, that is, you know what, it's good to carry a legacy. Yeah. It's horrible that you had to like race through that moment with the burden of his death on you, but it's good to carry a legacy and he had an honorable legacy. He had a good legacy and you should be proud of that. And I can see that you are carrying on that public service tradition in a big way. So I look forward to hearing that you have been sworn in. We will all celebrate with you.
Thank you.
And I know it's going to happen soon. And Adelita Grugalia, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Lincoln Project podcast. Call us anytime. We want to keep track of you and keep and follow your career as you make a big difference in DC.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It was a great interview. She's really one of these classic people. She comes from a political family, but that's also what you call public service. We sort of undercounted that in America these days, I think. So I'm really glad that Adelita Grijalva was on the show today. And I want to talk a little bit about why what's happening to her is so important right now. What's happening to her is a sign that this dangerous administration and this dangerous movement and this dangerous caucus they have in the House is cracking. There is a movement. Eric Swalwell has been talking about it. I've been starting to hear about it myself. There is a great degree of nervousness now in the House that Donald Trump is about to pardon Ghislaine Maxwell.
Who are we talking about?
Ghislaine Maxwell.
You know, I haven't heard the name in so long. I can say this, that I'd have to take a look at it. I would have to take a look. Did they reject that?
She wanted to appeal her conviction.
And what happened?
They said that they were not going to hear her appeal.
I see. Well, I'll take a look at it. I will speak to the DOJ. I wouldn't consider it or not consider it. I don't know anything about it. I will speak to the DOJ.
Why would she be a candidate for clemency,
sir? I don't know. I mean, I'd have to speak to the DOJ. I'll look at it. I have a lot of people have asked me for pardons. I call him Puff Daddy has asked me for a pardon.
But she was convicted of child sex trafficking.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to take a look at it. I'd have to ask DOJ. I didn't know they rejected it. I didn't know she was even asking for it, frankly.
He's thinking about it. They're playing around with it. Todd Blanche clearly took that offer to her in Tallahassee. All of this stuff is making the House members very nervous. The House and the Senate are seeing their polling about the shutdown take a real beating. This has been very bad for them. They are not getting what they thought they were going to get out of this. They're going to lose more seats. It's going to open up a wider battlefield for 2026 if they keep this up much longer. The combination of DOGE, the tariffs, the shutdown, and Russ Vought going through the government while the shutdown is happening with a chainsaw and furloughing and firing people is going to have a big economic impact. Now, her getting sworn in is not going to change the velocity of these disasters economically. But it is one more signal that they're closer and closer and closer to losing the majority in the Republican Party. It is one more signal that voters do not like what is happening. Voters are very unhappy with Trump. Donald Trump's numbers are profoundly weak. He may well declare the Insurrection Act to be in effect, but he does not have the political support of the country. Only about 23% of the people in this country are hard Trump supporters anymore. Only about 15% of the people in this country want the Insurrection Act to be invoked, even if they know what it is. Trump is on a very thin political sheet of ice right now. Stephen Miller and Kristi Noem and the rest of the crazies want him to declare the Insurrection Act.
And don't forget, and I haven't used it, but don't forget, I can use the Insurrection Act. 50% of the presidents almost have used that. And that's unquestioned power.
They want him to declare martial law. They want him to put troops in the streets to teach those people a lesson. And those people aren't just people who were here illegally. Those people are people who object to the Trump administration's policies. Those people are you and me. Those people are the resistance. Those people are the people who protest against what's going on in our streets, with ICE and the National Guard and soon active duty military forces being used to target American citizens. Because this isn't just about people who are here without their documentation. It's about sending you and me and everybody else a message that they'll use military force against you. They'll use violence against you. They'll bring the police or the National Guard or the 82nd Airborne against you or your city. It is the most un-American, unpatriotic, and reprehensible thing any president in our history has ever done. Donald Trump's talking about arresting the governor of Illinois, the mayor of Chicago, the mayor of Portland, the governor of Oregon. They're going to create the circumstances as best they can to cause an insurrection. They're going to create the circumstances as best they can to cause violence in the streets. That's what they're working on every day. Don't take the bait. Document everything. Protest peacefully. Do not comply in advance. And never, ever shut up. Those are rules that I follow every day. I hope you will too. Thanks for listening to the Lincoln Project podcast as always. You can also catch my other podcast, The Enemies List. You can catch a lot of other things that I do online for streaming. Tuesdays, the strategy session for Lincoln Square. Thursdays, the breakdown with the Lincoln Project. Fridays, Behind the Numbers with the Wilsons. We're looking forward to having you guys tune into that, where Andrew Wilson and I tear apart the polls every week and analyze just what's happening behind the public opinion curtain. You can also check out my Substack, Against All Enemies. You can check out Lincoln Square. We are deep in the pro-democracy fight. Hope you'll join us. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you soon.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.